Welcome back, listeners, to a fresh new edition of the Built on the Border podcast. It is Tuesday, June 30th, and I'm joined in the dining room, aka the studio, with, as usual, Mr. Tommy Watson and Mr. Broderick Johnson. How's it going, guys?
Oh, it's pretty good. We got a lot of good stuff we can talk about this week.
Yeah, it was a busy weekend for, I think, all of us. Tommy, why don't you give me a little recap on what you did this weekend? Get a little bit of a first-time experience, did you not?
I did. I attempted to smoke ribs for the first time this weekend, which went fairly well. Broderick helped me out for a little bit. We struggled at first trying to get the temperature right, but I got some advice from my uncle, and the ribs turned out pretty good. I think I could have left them on a little longer, but they tasted fine to me. I got some left over. You guys want to try them?
Yeah, I actually, that's why I was calling you earlier. I was going to see if it was okay if I tried some, but I remember you saying it was okay, so I've had two or three of them now to this point. They're pretty good. They're pretty good ribs. What did you use for the rub? Did you use a dry rub or did you use a wet rub?
I used a little bit of both. I did. So I put some Jack Daniel's mustard on there, some Frank's Red Hot.
I could taste a little bit of the mustard, a little bit of the spiciness from the Red Hot. And then I noticed, did you use like an Arthur Bryant's rub on there?
An Arthur Bryant's dry rub.
I thought they were excellent. You know, I would have been really interested to see what they tasted like fresh out of the smoker, but I'm impressed. I'm proud of you, man. I think my dad would be proud, you know, to know that there's someone who maybe would have fallen under his tutelage at some point of barbecuing that tried to master the art of smoking ribs.
I know. I'm kind of excited to try them now because I will say when I tried them on Saturday, I was not necessarily sober, so the taste was a little different then.
Yeah. Well, I had a busy weekend, too. I was out in Kentucky for the Tough Mudder race.
Oh, yeah? How'd that go?
It was an experience. I finished, which was important for me. It was a 10.1-mile race, which is the shortest they do for Tough Mudder. It was out actually around the Kentucky Speedway. It was really cool. I'm in still in some physical pain. Been icing my ankles and my feet because that took the brunt of the punishment on Saturday, but I did it with, you know, two of my best friends from college and my friend's girlfriend and his brother Andy, and it was a great experience. I think we all kind of built up a new sense of camaraderie with each other. It's very, you know, you look at it as this kind of big challenge where there's all these physical tests, but it's really a mental challenge as well, and it tests your ability to, you know, kind of push through these obstacles and you know, you find out things about yourself you didn't know before. So I feel really fortunate to have been able to participate, and I recommend it to both you guys, Brody and Tommy. You know, it gets you motivated to exercise and kind of try new ways of working out, and I loved it. So I'm definitely gonna do one again, hopefully in October when they come to St. Louis. But yeah, it was an awesome experience, but still got some bumps and bruises I'm nursing. So I think that might be the case for about a week or so. But it was fun. Brody, how was your weekend?
It was great. I spent time kind of helping Tommy barbecue, do the steaks, and then was able, fortunate to go to the Sporting KC game against the Rapids. So 2-0 victory.
That's great. Sporting. Well, it sounds like it was solid weekends for all of us, and it was also a solid weekend for the Royals.
Oh, yeah.
We'll go ahead and get into that. Looking back to the beginning of the season was when the Royals were kind of on their bad boys tear, and it all started with the series against the Oakland A's, the game that we were at. The Brett Lowry slide into Alcides Escobar. Two bench clearing incidents during that series. Now the Royals go to Oakland, and they take care of business the way that the Royals have been doing all season, and they sweep the Oakland A's in the weekend series. Tommy, what did it mean for this team to go into Oakland and shut the A's down the way that they did?
Well, the A's have been an interesting team this year because if you look at the standings and their run differential, I think they're like third or fourth in the American League in terms of run differential. They have a huge positive one, but they're like in last place in the West.
Right.
And they've been trying to figure out their season, and so they think they're a good team when, I mean, wins and losses, they're not. And
right.
I think the Royals showed them that they're not, definitely not better than us. Royals are 5-1 against them on the season, and I don't think we're going to face them again because
yeah.
I don't anticipate them making the playoffs.
Yeah, it was just really great to see these guys. The resilience that this ball club has had. This is a team that's, you know, been subject to a fair amount of injuries this year.
Yeah.
We were fairly lucky last year in the fact that we didn't really have to suffer through a lot of injuries, you know, minus the Eric Hosmer hand injury towards the end of the season. But that wasn't really didn't really make a difference because Billy Butler was able to step in and have a big effect. But right now you've got Hosmer, who's sitting out some games. Kane's sitting out some games. Escobar's banged up with the finger injury. You know, there are other guys. Dyson's nursing that groin injury. And our rotations hasn't been very healthy this season either. But you just see the resilience continue to manifest itself in this team. And they're kicking ass and taking names. They went on a 4-game win streak through the weekend. Had a tough loss to the Astros last night. Joe Blanton had his first really bad outing as a Kansas City Royal in 3 starts. So he's now 2-1 on the season. But the reality is, we're the best team in the American League right now. We're the second best team in the majors behind the Cardinals. We went on a 4-game win streak last week. We've been getting good, not great outings from our starters, which I have to start to ask, does it matter if we get a good performance from our starting rotation because our bullpen's been playing so great? So it's this season just keeps on building, and it almost seems like it's not sustainable, but every time we question whether or not the Royals can keep it up, they keep on answering and answering and answering. So with the second half of the season kind of reaching that halfway point, what do you expect to see from the Royals through the second half of the season? We'll start with Tommy, then we'll go to you, Brody.
You know, I expect, I mean, it's going to sound kind of boring. I expect to see more of the same. I'm interested to see if they make any moves at the trade deadline, maybe for starting pitching or not. Mm. But, I mean, the way the starting pitching has just been up and down, there's not a single starter we have right now that just clearly says, get him out of there. I mean, they've each kind of had, other than, like, Volquez, they've each had a game where it's like, oh, my God, how are you a starter?
Right.
But Chris Young actually hasn't had that bad of a game either. But
Blanton and Young have both had one spot start that was questionable.
Yeah.
You look at those games where they give up, you know, 5 or 6 runs during their outing. Other than that, there haven't really, Volquez has really been the only solid guy. Vargas has struggled. Guthrie has struggled. Now with the rotation starting to shape up the way it is, Blanton did have a rough outing last night. Ventura's about to come back up from Omaha. Who loses his spot in rotation? My instinct says that Jeremy Guthrie loses that spot. Brody, what do you think?
I think it's Blanton. I mean, I know Ned Yost has said that he'll have the next his opportunity to start and everything, but I mean, Guthrie has shown he is resilient. He does have a bad outing or two, but I think Blanton, just for him being a new guy and Guthrie having been there all year, I think Guthrie is not one that we take out of the starting rotation.
And I do agree with you from the point of that he's a guy that's been with this team now for a little bit of time. He was instrumental during that playoff run last year, and I think that's why so many fans are hesitant to give him the kick to the curb. And it wouldn't be a kick to the curb. He would just be removed from the rotation. And I say it's Guthrie. When you look at the numbers, Guthrie's had 15 starts this year. He's 5-6 on the year. He's 6-5 on the year, so he does have a positive win differential in his win-loss. But his ERA is 5.68, nearing 5.7. Blanton has had one bad start in which he gave up a 6 earned run yesterday to the Astros. And his ERA is still 3.1, or 3.2 if you really round it up, in 3 starts. He's played in 10 games. His ERA is still very low. He's shown in 2 of his 3 starts that he can be an effective starter. I would continue to ride the Blanton train until we need Guthrie to come in, because his last outing was pitiful. He had another poor performance in his last outing. He just hasn't shown a consistency enough to merit keeping that starting rotation. He's had 15 games to prove that he has a spot. I don't think one quality start every 5 games pitched merits a spot in the rotation.
I mean,
Tommy, what are your thoughts?
Well, so, I mean, ultimately, I think Ned's going to stick with Guthrie because Ned's a patient man. And he likes to stick with these guys. He stands by these guys. Guthrie was the 5 starter at the beginning of the season. So, I mean, his ERA right now is not great, but like a 4.5 ERA for a 5 starter, which is about what it would be if you take away that 1 inning, 11 runs given up against the Yankees, the Memorial Day Massacre. But I also took some time to look closer at his game logs, and I noticed that in 15 starts, he's got 5 quality starts. Not necessarily impressive. Well, just not impressive at all. But I also looked at, in 6 more starts, he was within either 1 run or 1 inning of having a quality start, meaning there were some games where he went 5 2/3, only gave up 3 runs, or went 6 innings, 7 innings, and gave up 4 runs. So that's potentially 11 quality starts there. He's just had, like, it's about 1 out of every 4 or 5 starts with him, he just gets horrendous.
Right, and I don't deny that I think Blanton is better served in the bullpen for this ball club. I don't think Guthrie will be as effective at coming out of the bullpen I think Blanton's been there this season, so he knows what's expected of him. But I would like to see, just from a pure performance standpoint, I'd like to see how far we can ride this Blanton train. I know last night was rough for Blanton, but before that he had been essentially lights out in his two starts. So I'm interested to see what else we can get out of him. The All-Star voting came out yesterday. I kind of want to move into that. We are now coming back down to earth, you know. The Royals fandom was the fans were riding high for a while there with eight starters, you know, that were potentially going to be named to the All-Star game. I think now we're starting to see it even out a little bit. I do think the best team in the league should have the most players starting, and that's probably going to be the case. Some races are getting a little tighter. If you look at the shortstop race, Alcides Escobar is starting to relinquish some ground. Gordon is just, you know, about 1.5 million votes ahead of Yoenis Cespedes. So Tigers fans are getting out and voting. But we now have four players potentially going to start in the – or excuse me, five players that are currently slated to start in the All-Star game. Salvador Perez, Alcides Escobar, Omar Infante, Lorenzo Cain, and Alex Gordon, with Moustakas and Morales being on the list last time that have now dropped out. Morales is now 200,000 votes behind Nelson Cruz, which I think is still ground that he could make up. And Moustakas is now 1.5 million votes behind Josh Donaldson, the all-star third baseman for the Blue Jays, formerly of the Oakland A's. We know him from last season. Do you think that the current Royals in there are the ones that are deserving of those all-star spots?
So let's see. We got Perez. Yeah, I think he's deserving. Gordon and Kane, I both think, are deserving. Escobar, I think, is deserving. Omar, obviously not. That was more just fun.
Right.
I mean, so for the Royals that are in there, I think it's right. Moose and Donaldson are kind of a toss-up. I know I think most of the country wants Donaldson. He is having a very good season. I think Royals fans are just really trying to get behind Moose because this is a fantastic season for
right.
Moose, and we want to see him rewarded for it.
Right, and realistically, when you look at the guys that have been the most important players to the Royals this year, Salvador Perez comes to mind, leading the team in home runs, and he's that leader behind the plate. Eric Hosmer comes into mind because he's that vocal leader in the clubhouse. He leads by example as well. Alex Gordon, defensive extraordinaire, not necessarily having a great offensive season, not a bad one, but he's that kind of lead by example, silent assassin that we have in the clubhouse. Lorenzo Cain, arguably one of the most valuable players in the American League when you look at the numbers in terms of what he's capable of doing defensively and offensively and on the base path. And then Alcides Escobar, who's arguably one of the best, is probably the best defensive shortstop in the American League and is capable of batting for a good average and getting on base. So you look at those guys. And the key guys on the those have been the key guys on the roster this year. There's one guy in there that hasn't necessarily been a key guy, and that's Omar Infante, who at some point in the season has had his spot questioned as a starter. Do you kind of hope, for the sake of saving face, and we've talked about this over and over about Altuve or Infante, you'd obviously rather see Moose or Morales in there over Infante. But is the joke kind of run out? Does Jose Altuve really deserve to be in there? Would you rather, just as a baseball fan, see him in there? Or are you still okay with Infante retaining that starting spot?
Hashtag vote Omar.
Okay. That's
I'm gonna
simple
stick with
enough.
Omar, because Altuve is going to end up there anyways. He's not. He's probably – well, he may get elected anyways. But if he doesn't become the starter, he will still go to the All-Star game.
Yeah.
He will be picked. He's – you know, he's, I think, everyone else's choice
yeah.
for second base. So.
To use a Hudler expression, he dropped a load on the Royals last night with a pretty deep home run that went up into the second deck of the outfield. So I think he was trying to prove maybe a little point to the voters last night with his performance against the Royals.
Let's see if Omar answers tonight, maybe gets his first home run
yeah.
of the season.
You know what I think would be awesome is if Omar Infante does get the start and goes like 2 for 2 with a home run. Like that would be just absolutely sticking it to all the critics of the voting process this year, and I think we are amongst those critics of the voting process this year. So moving away from the Royals, we kind of went a little tangential with that one. Want to talk about True Detective because we're two episodes in now. We've talked about how McConaughey and Harrelson in that first season really kind of set the stage for what this season is. It's drastically different. I don't think anyone's denying that. There are now four central characters, and maybe there are only now three central characters to this story, with the potential murder of Ray Velcoro, Colin Farrell's character at the end of the second episode, by the crow masked or bird masked killer that we presume also murdered Ben Casper, the Vinci City manager who was holding $5 million of Frank Semyon's money, Vince Vaughn's character. So we see all these stories starting to kind of mesh together with now Ray's presumed death, because I think a shotgun shot at point blank range would literally probably just blow a hole through your stomach. And now the potential investigation of his death as well. So the episode opens with Vince Vaughn's character laying in bed with his wife, discussing kind of the two watermarks on the ceiling, which I didn't really understand. It kind of seemed like a very, obscure kind of philosophical monologue that didn't really seem to find its place. But we now learned that Vince Vaughn's character, Frank, was subject to some abuse as a child. His father locked in the basement, and Frank talks about his survivalistic nature, where he smashed, you know, the rats in the basement until there was just goop on his hands, and his father finally came back after 2 days and let him out. So we learned kind of from that monologue the resilience of a character like Frank Semyon, who's really going to do whatever it takes to survive. And I think in terms of his survival here, we're referencing him getting his money and making his name. He talks about a legacy and what you leave after you're dead. And he said, you know, he wants to buy property and, you know, you can't take it with you when you die. And that's what he wants to leave with his children. So there's also that fact that him and his wife don't have children yet. And he talks about leaving his legacy, a legitimate legacy, which we touched on last week, which he talks about in the first episode. But we see that legitimate legacy starting to crumble a little bit, because he, like we saw in the basement, we saw from his description of the basement with when his father locked him down there, he's really willing to do whatever it takes to get himself to where he needs to be. So we see him starting to fall back into those criminal ways with the beating of the bookie out in on the side of the highway, and we see him starting to kind of put the pressure on Ray to start doing more crooked cop work for him, which clearly Ray's done in the past. What have you seen in the evolution of the Frank Semyon character, or Semyon, however you say his last name, and the portrayal that Vince Vaughn has done so far? What are your thoughts on that character?
You know, I think he's doing okay. I thought it was kind of weird the way the show started, but I didn't understand what the water spots had to do with this story. I like the story because I like what it kind of reveals about his character, and I like the way that it's kind of going about how he's going to do what it takes to survive. So I'm interested to see where that goes. But, I mean, I think Vince Vaughn's doing an okay job representing that.
Yeah. And the only thing I liked about that scene was the transition from the watermarks on the ceiling to the Ben Casper's, burnt out eyes. So there's been some development with Taylor Kitsch's character, Ray, who I don't know if you guys got this vibe, but it seems like there was some sort of Oedipus complex with his mother.
His mom was weird.
I don't know if she's his biological mother, but the conversation was almost overtly sexual in the way she got jealous about his current girlfriend, who we see him split up from towards the end of the episode. Not a whole lot of development in terms of his relationship with his girlfriend or presumed wife, other than the fact that he's clearly shut her out as a result of PTSD and what he had done while serving, you know, his term over in Iraq. So his character's starting to grow a little bit more interesting. There's some questions of whether or not, you know, his homophobia is an indication of his, in fact, homosexuality. So there's some questions about that. So I'm interested to see how that character evolves. And of course, there's Annie. Bezerides, who has that estranged relationship with her father, goes and meets with the psychiatrist with Ray, who treated Ben Casper, who was Rick Springfield, the musician, the Australian musician who's known for Jesse's Girl. I don't know if you noticed this when they go into that meeting with him, but there is a painting of a black bird or crow, whatever it is, behind Ray Velcoro's head.
Really?
I don't know if that's some foreshadowing or if maybe the psychiatrist, Rick Springfield, is somehow involved in this cult or whoever these killers are that murdered Ray Velcoro, presumably. Again, I'm saying presumably because we don't know if he died or not. We're not 100% sure. I would, like I said, I'd have to imagine a buckshot at that range would just blow a hole through your gut. So that might pose a question to you. Do you think that Ray Velcoro is dead?
And I think unless what we saw at the end of that episode is some kind of dream sequence type thing. I think he's dead. He took a shotgun to the back and then one basically point blank to the stomach. I don't know how you survive that unless someone is to immediately rush in and, you know, kill the guy who shot him and possibly save him, but I don't see him surviving that.
Things I saw raised from a theory's perspective is that, one, he was shot with non-lethal rounds, so it's like sandbag or something that would pierce the skin but not necessarily kill him. Two, that he was wearing a bulletproof vest. And they posited those theories for two reasons. One, that webcam discovers in the closet is a feed to some sort of fetish site about death-related sexual activity. So that's why they think maybe that's what that was going on. They talk, the coroner talks about the way that Ben Casper's body was positioned after he had died. So there's some question on exactly what was done to his body during that time. Another theory is that Ray Velcoro is trying to stage his own death. There's that conversation that precludes his shooting with Frank, where he talks about, you know, almost committing suicide. So maybe Frank's trying to fake his own death. Brody, I'll turn it over to you. What do you think's going on with Ray Velcoro? Do you think this is the last time we see him alive in this part of the story? Maybe we see some flashbacks. What do you think we're going to see from that character?
You know, I hadn't really thought about the two theories that you brought up, but I think the sandbag thing, it kind of thawed my mind of maybe he has now become a torture victim of this cult and everything because he's gone on. But I definitely like the fact that his last conversation with Rachel McAdams of is he corrupt or not?
Right.
And he just doesn't answer it. And I was really hoping that it'd be like, I really liked his character of just, he was going to be the one on both sides, delaying the investigation, but also trying to find out as a officer what was going on.
Well, he was going to delay the investigation for the city of Vinci and while at the same time trying to figure out where Ben Casper was for Vince Vaughn. So it's interesting. There's so many different parts. I hope that the character's alive because I do like I do like Ray Velcoro's character. I understand people saying that bringing him back would be cheap. It's another, you know, fiction trope that's been used over and over again. But I think the frustration that people have is because a lot of the same people that watch True Detective are the same people that watch Game of Thrones. So they probably don't want to see the same thing happen with Ray Velcoro as we presume will happen with Jon Snow. But what I've asked people to do and people I've discussed True Detective with today is you have to view the two, and you just have to, as separate entities. Game of Thrones is not True Detective, and True Detective is not Game of Thrones. They should not be compared because they use certain storytelling devices, and you shouldn't discount one storytelling device because someone else already used it. Death fakeouts happen in TV all the time, and they're going to continue to happen. It's a famous, you know, way of throwing off the viewer. You don't know if they're dead or not. So obviously, you know, we have to wait another 5 days to see what's going to happen, but I think some major things will be revealed, not just about Ray Velcoro's character or Frank Semien's character, but about maybe Ray Velcoro's relationship with his wife and maybe the true parentage of his son. So we have to wait and see for next week. Another bit of pop culture I wanted to touch on that came out this week is the I'm Chris Farley trailer, which is the documentary that has been in the works for a little while now about the life and, unfortunately, death of Chris Farley. It was based on the biography that his brother wrote about him called The Chris Farley Show. Tommy, growing up with you, there's no doubt that Chris Farley was huge to us growing up. You know,
literally.
He was, our favorite movie is, has our name attached to it, and it kind of holds a special place for me, and I know it does for you as well. The documentary came out that kind of touched on his rise to fame and then, of course, his unfortunate downfall into, you know, depression and drugs and alcohol and everything. Talk to me a little bit about how growing up, how important Chris Farley, just as a comedian and as an icon, was to you. You know, he did pass away in 1998, which was, we were 7 years old at the time, but his legacy was something we grew up with. So why don't you talk to me about that a little bit?
Well, the man is basically single-handedly responsible for a movie that I can quote for probably 20 minutes, Tommy Boy. That's my favorite comedy movie of all time, and I can sit and watch that movie and quote it all day.
We've used clips of it on the podcast
before. Yeah, exactly. He's got some pretty good, he's on Saturday Night Live, so many good sketches on there.
Best of Chris Farley, there's so much, you almost feel sold short when you watch it because you know there's so much great, so many great sketches that they couldn't fit into that 1 hour special of Best of Chris Farley. When I look back on it, you know, I don't miss an opportunity to quote that movie. I don't miss an opportunity to make a reference. I think I probably do it on a weekly, if not daily basis, or at least think about it. What do you think the world would be like today if Chris Farley were still around? What do you think would be different about the comedy landscape? We see all these huge comedy stars that go on to take on these big, these bigger roles, sometimes dramatic roles. Where do you think Chris Farley would be if he were still alive today?
I don't know, man. That's kind of hard to imagine. I mean, one of the few things I remember hearing about that we would know for sure would be different is he was the voice of Shrek
right
before his death, and he had actually recorded most of the lines.
Like 80-90% of the dialogue.
But once he passed, they had to switch it, so that's how Mike Myers got the part.
Yeah.
And he did a fantastic job as well, and I'm sure Chris Farley did a great job too. So
yeah.
That's the most immediate thing I know, but it's hard to tell because you never know how his career may turn. He may have could go the Adam Sandler way where he's done a couple good movies and then kind of done a lot of movies no one really wants to see, or he could have became a serious actor.
Could have gone the Robin Williams route. I mean, he had that much talent.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no doubt that he had, you know, the skills and the presence to be a dramatic actor because we saw those dramatic parts of movies that he was in. You know, in Tommy Boy, in Black Sheep, where you see him as more of an empathetic character than just a goofball. Brody, we didn't really grow up together necessarily. We weren't friends until high school. But why don't you talk about Chris Farley and, you know, your perception of him growing up and how, you know, those moves, you know, I guess Tommy Boy, namely, how big it was for you as a kid.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say it was a kid. I didn't really start watching that movie until high school. But definitely high school really got, like, Tommy Boy, Black Sheep. I mean, just,
Beverly Hills Ninja, which is an underrated work of his. Just for me, Chris Farley was Tommy Boy was the first PG-13 movie I ever saw. It was without the permission of my parents. It was over at the Baker's house. Tommy was there. I think we watched it twice that night just because we loved that movie so much. And when you're a kid, you don't get tired of seeing something funny over and over and over and over again. And we still haven't gotten tired of it today. What are you hoping to see from this documentary?
You know, I'm hoping to see, like, a different side of Chris because we all saw the funny side, and they talk about that in the preview for it, about how everyone knows the funny side, that his public image. But no, not very many people know what he was like kind of behind the scenes or, like, you know, real personal. We know he apparently had some problems. He was into drugs. Which, you know, depression, I guess, too. So
we all know that story, but I think there's more to it, and I think we're going to learn more about who he was as a man because he clearly had a high, you know, big impact on a lot of these people, and he clearly was a good guy by the way these people talk about him. He had such a profound impact on people like David Spade and Lorne Michaels and Adam Sandler, and he was an icon for a while. So I'm excited to see that documentary when it comes out in a few weeks, and I think we should try and go see it at one of the art house theaters here when it does debut, because it is going to be showing, I believe, both on the Plaza and in Crown Center too, where they show those documentary films. So it's definitely something we're going to get out and see. So shifting gears away from pop culture, we'll go ahead and talk about the Jayhawks versus Canada and the abroad trip that they're now on. The team looked fantastic against Canada in the two game set they played against them at the Sprint Center this week. Really cool moment. They allowed KU Hall of Famer and broadcast icon Max Falkenstein to be the honorary coach. He was on the bench on Friday night, which was really cool. Growing up, we listened to a lot of games on the radio, football, basketball, and Max Falkenstein was always that voice you heard. He's kind of like, you know, the only parallel I can make is he's about as important to KU sports as Denny Matthews is to Royals broadcasting. But back to the game, we saw a lot of really great performances from the veteran players on this team. Wayne Selden had 22 points and 10 rebounds in the game on Friday night and 13 points on Tuesday. He averaged about 16 points through those games. Selden and Ellis both averaged 17.5 points through those games. Mason looked terrific in both games, averaging 22 points. Defense still a little lackluster, but it's looking really promising for a squad that's ranked, you know, in the top four preseason poll wise. And it's a team that can really go about 12 deep in terms of their roster. And they have something that Kansas teams, you know, in recent history haven't had, at least since about 2011, which is experience. They're molded very similarly to those 2008-2011 teams. And I'm going to go out on a limb based on the performances I saw against the Canadian college team and say anything less than a Final Four appearance this season would be a disappointment for this Kansas team. They have no excuses. They have the talent to go deep. They have the talent and the experience to win. So they've now embarked on their trip to Korea for the University Games. They arrived in Korea yesterday. 25-hour trip to get from the United States to Korea, which is a really long day. I imagine the jet lag is going to have play a significant factor in their games. They play Turkey on Friday, Brazil on Sunday, and the games are going to be televised on ESPNU. It's going to be difficult to watch them because they're going to be broadcasting anytime between 1 a.m. and 4 a.m. here stateside, Central Time. But it's going to be a first look at the Jayhawks going into the 2015-2016 season. I'm excited to see, you know, these younger guys get an opportunity to play. Some of these guys aren't going to be able to travel with the team. Mikhailik won't be able to travel. Sheik Diallo won't be able to travel. But it's a chance for these guys to get some really great experience against some solid college teams. And like I said, I don't expect anything less than a Final Four appearance. I think this team is built to go deep. And I'm just excited. There were some former Jayhawks that made some headlines in the news recently. Notably, KU freshman and his short-lived career at Kansas. His basketball career may be even more short-lived. Cliff Alexander going undrafted in the draft on Thursday night. Did you expect to see that? He was projected maybe to go in the first round and to fall all the way out of those 60 picks. Ty, what are your projections for Cliff Alexander and his career as he now signs a rookie free agent contract with the Brooklyn Nets?
Well, it's definitely not a good thing he didn't get drafted. Although I think, considering the circumstances of it, it's more likely that he will make an NBA team because it's not like he fell out of shape or anything, you know, like Sharon Collins did when he left KU. Mm-hmm. It's more like, you know, he got suspended for the whole, was it the whole Big 12 tournament?
He missed the entire Big 12 tournament.
And the entire NCAA tournament. Right. And so that's kind of a chance, too, for a lot of the teams to get good looks at these players when they start going against top talent in the country. And he missed out on that. So I can see why teams took a pass on him. Definitely a lot of good players out there, too. So I'm hopeful that he will make it to a team because he's still a talented player. 1 year removed from being a top five high school prospect. So I think it's still bright for him, although he's not in the most ideal circumstances.
Yeah. And Brody, as a Mizzou fan, you're no stranger to players being left out of the first round. Jordan Clarkson and Jabari Brown, both were drafted in the first round. Jabari Brown, not even drafted last year. Both found their way onto the Lakers squad last year and played impactful minutes, especially Jordan Clarkson. So you know that team players can make a difference. So what, as a Mizzou fan, what would your words to KU fans be in terms of wanting to see Cliff Alexander make an impact in the NBA?
I mean, it'd just be cheer for him in the D League for the time being and just hope that the team he's playing for goes through a rut that the Lakers did where they have to throw in some of these D League players, get the rookies out, and hopefully his preparation carries him in.
Yeah, and that's what Self has said. He alluded to the fact that the best guy in the gym when he was suspended, it was Cliff Alexander. He was working hard. He was trying to make all the plays. And the pressure was kind of off. Now the pressure's on a little bit to perform well in that Vegas Summer League where we'll see him put on a Nets uniform and play for the Brooklyn Nets in Vegas. Kelly Oubre also went. He was drafted this week on Thursday night. No surprise there that he was going to be drafted in the first round, although he fell a little bit later than we expected. Drafted 16th overall, then his rights were traded to the Washington Wizards. So he's going to get an opportunity to play almost right away because there is a little bit of a small forward gap there for the Washington Wizards. Paul Pierce presumably will not re-sign with the Wizards. There's some talk of him potentially signing with either the Clippers or signing back in Boston. And he's going to get a chance to run with some really good young talent in Bradley Beal and John Wall. So I'm certainly excited about that. Just kind of want to go over general reactions to the draft. Of course, no surprise that Karl Anthony Towns went number one overall to the Minnesota Timberwolves. Then it kind of got interesting. Some players fell later than they were supposed to. We thought Justice Winslow was going to go earlier in the draft, and he did. Tommy, do you have any reactions to the draft on Thursday?
Well, I was kind of surprised based off what I had read that the Lakers did not pick Okafor, and that he actually dropped to the next pick, the 76ers.
Yep.
So I think, and from what I've read, the Lakers, everyone says the Lakers look like they did a really good job in picking
D'Angelo Russell.
So it'll be interesting to see how they go. And then I think Justice Winslow, dropping to 10 was actually a great value pick for Miami.
Yeah,
because he goes into a good organization, a talented roster. I mean, D-Wade did opt out, but he's not necessarily gone.
Right. Well, and, you know, that Miami team, if you look at it, you know, the hope is that, and I think Pat Riley will be able to re-sign Goran Dragic. They're going to be able to get Wade in there for maybe a little bit less than he's asking for, but probably still going to make him happy because he's sacrificed over $20 million to help this Heat team win championships during that run when they had the big three. So I think the biggest steal of the draft was Winslow.
Yeah.
I think across the board, biggest steal of the draft. Then I think the second biggest steal was Devin Booker, the shooting guard out of Kentucky, falling to the Suns at 13. I think he's going to be a really, really good talent. And then my other big steal of the draft would be RJ Hunter, the shooting guard out of Georgia State, who was kind of that member of that Cinderella team that upset Baylor in the first round. He hit that big shot to force overtime against the Bears. He went 28 to the Celtics. I think he's going to be a really impactful player later down the road in his NBA career as he kind of grows into his body a little bit. So I think he's a great fit there with Boston. I think the biggest reach of the draft, and I think a lot of people would have to agree, was again by the Celtics taking Terry Rozier with the number 16 pick, the number 15 pick. Kind of raised some eyebrows. Interesting there. But reaction overall to the draft, I think kind of went as expected. We saw the two Wisconsin standouts end up in good situations, with Frank Kaminsky going to the Charlotte Hornets. He's going to get an opportunity to play there, I would presume right away, alongside Al Jefferson, and is going to play some impactful minutes. And then Sam Dekker kind of reaching a good position with the Houston Rockets, who were a playoff team that went deep this year into the Western Conference Finals, and he had some shooting to that team. Going to free agency, though, like you said, Wade opted out. A lot of big names have opted out of their final year of their player option contracts. LeBron has opted out, but we know LeBron will probably re-sign with the Cleveland Cavaliers, and Love has opted out too, and presumably will re-sign with the Cavaliers as well. Now, two of the biggest franchises in the NBA have had their historically worst seasons last year, the Lakers and the Knicks. They have to make some big moves in free agency, and it's looking like they may not even be able to get some of the guys that they want to. The Knicks drafted Kristaps Porzingis, the Latvian player who they expect at some point to be the cornerstone of their franchise, but they still have a lot of work to do in free agency. There are some big names out there on the board still. Marc Gasol, LaMarcus Aldridge, Jimmy Butler, Monte Ellis. So there are some still names out there. For the Knicks and the Lakers to get to the point where they want to be, do you think that the free agency that they're going to have this year is crucial to get one of those guys, or do you think that they can wait a season? Brody, what are your thoughts?
You know, I think at least for the Lakers, you got to think that they probably don't have another season because Kobe right. is probably going to be done next season, won't have anywhere close to in 2 years.
Right.
So I think this year, this offseason, really is do or die for yeah. them.
And you had mentioned before you think LaMarcus Aldridge would be the best fit to kind of come in there and mm-hmm. put the Lakers in a position to be a playoff team, which is difficult in the West. But, you know, LaMarcus Aldridge is a power forward slash center yeah. that can stretch the floor a little bit. You can pair him up with a starting lineup of D'Angelo Russell, Kobe Bryant, Julius Randle, and then LaMarcus Aldridge. That's a decent team. That's you fill point. In a stopgap at the three position. What do you think Aldridge could bring to the Lakers? Do you think it's veteran leadership? Do you think it's just an all-star presence? What are you expecting to see if he was to land in Los Angeles?
You know, I think it's probably first just new life. Just
right.
back up the players of saying by the ownership of we want to win this
right.
year. This is Kobe's our team leader, but we're going to bring in this other veteran to maintain just a West impact on the West.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we saw the Bulls extend that five-year mm-hmm. offer sheet to Jimmy Butler, but the Lakers are still very much in play to sign Jimmy Butler as well, and they can probably throw a really difficult contract to negotiate, at least from the Bulls side, much like the Rockets did last year with offering that heavily front-loaded contract to Chandler Parsons, which the Dallas Mavericks did, offering it to Chandler Parsons, which the Rockets weren't really able to match. So it's a really interesting free agency period, which will begin tomorrow night. People can start signing. I think it's going to be a really big – it's going to be a flurry of big deals that take place and a lot
think,
of money changing hands.
It'll be like in years past where the commissioners had to step in and say this deal doesn't work, or do you think it is kind of more ownership run? And
you know, I think that issue is going to happen when you see some sign and trades take place. Mm-hmm. I think that you may see the Trailblazers try and sign and trade LaMarcus Aldridge. But again, there's tax issues that have to work out there, and we know that the Lakers are no strangers to going over the luxury tax, but that's an issue they have to consider, especially when Kobe Bryant's eating up $25 million of that salary cap. So it's going to be an interesting free agency period, and I think the teams that have the most to gain and the most to lose in this scenario are the Knicks, there are the Lakers, and then the teams that have the most to gain but not really anything to lose are teams like the Grizzlies, teams like the Spurs, who need to be able to either re-sign their current talent like Kawhi Leonard and Tim Duncan and Marcus Gasol for the Grizzlies, or be able to bring in a big-name free agent guy like LaMarcus Aldridge. So it's going to be really interesting to see how it plays out. I think it's going to be an entertaining free agency period. And this is my favorite time of the year for the NBA because everything shakes up and kind of, you know, you see how things are going to manifest themselves moving into the new season. So I'm excited, certainly. You guys not being huge NBA fans, I know Brody's excited. Tommy, your NBA fandom's still a little fledgling. We'll work on that.
I'm trying to get excited about it because I want to follow NBA more. I feel dumb. I feel like I can't talk to you guys sometimes about NBA. So I want to follow this next season. Yeah. I will try and follow this offseason.
We'll get you up to scuff. And, you know, they're going to be – I mean, I think it's the emerging, you know, professional sports league in the country. There's – I mean, basketball really is the global sport that's taking over, you know, aside from soccer. And, you know, I think – everyone's kind of their eyes are on free agency this year, especially with the Knicks and the Lakers, to see what they're going to do. So that does it for this week of the Built on the Border podcast. Had a lot to talk about this week, and hopefully the next week supplies us with some more stuff to talk about. Hopefully this Women's World Cup game ends up victorious for the women's United States women's team, currently in a 0-0 tie, 0-0, sorry to not use the soccer lingo, Brody, a 0-0 tie with the German team. This is a big game for them. It's a big game for them to get back to the Women's World Cup final and make a statement that they are the best team in the world. Crushing loss to Japan last time in the Women's World Cup. So hopefully this team can rebound. Looking for a big performance out of Hope Solo in the semifinal game, and she's delivered so far, maintaining a 0-0 tie. So we'll be back next week with another edition of the Built on the Border podcast. Not sure if it'll come on Monday or Tuesday, depending on how the holiday shakes out. But we will continue to deliver, hopefully, what we consider to be great content to you guys and talk about the popular topics in the world of sports and pop culture. So for Tommy Watson and for Brody Johnson, this is Tom Randolph. We're going to send you guys out with another song, one of our personal favorites from one of our personal favorite bands, who was just in Kansas City this weekend. We're going to leave you guys with Beasts of Burden by the Rolling Stones. Did you guys happen to see the performance with Ed Sheeran that was on the video made its way on the internet this week?
I did not, but now that I know that that's there, I will go watch
it. It's pretty cool. Listeners, go watch Ed Sheeran perform Beasts of Burden with the Rolling Stones. Again, for Tommy Watson and Roy Johnson, this is Tommy Randolph. Have a great week out there, sports fans. Enjoy the 4th of July weekend and be patriot out there. Peace.